When we build a physical house, we really obsess over the locks on the front door. We install the heavy deadbolt, we wire up the smart alarm system, maybe we even, put up some of those motion sensor lights out in the driveway.
Right. Yeah, it's that classic perimeter defense. We spend like all our energy just trying to keep the bad guys out of the yard in the first place.
Exactly. But imagine this scenario for a second. What if the bad guys don't even bother trying to pick your state-of-the-art lock? What if instead they infiltrate the lumber yard like months before you even break ground? What if the very bricks, the wooden beams, the cement you're buying to build your fortress already have these tiny, invisible doors built right into them before you even hammer the first nail?
Man, that paints a pretty unsettling picture. But unfortunately, I mean, that is the exact reality we're facing in the digital world right now.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're getting into. So, welcome back to Cyber Mornings Daily. In today's deep dive, we're taking the complex tech and cybersecurity news of the day, stripping away all that confusing jargon, and really just extracting clear, actionable insights for you. And that goes for you no matter what your technical background is.
Absolutely.
Today, our mission is to critically explore this whole concept of trust in the digital supply chain. We've got a stack of recent sources detailing three very distinct cybersecurity events.
Yeah, three pretty major ones.
Right. We've got the Glassworm V2 campaign, which was targeting software developers, a cascading supply chain attack that led to a really big data leak for the security company Checkmarx, and finally, the geopolitical hacktivism of a group called Phantom Core, who were exploiting enterprise video conferencing software.
Which is wild. And if there's, a core theme to keep in mind as we go through these sources with you today, it ties right back to your lumberyard analogy.
Right.
The modern threat landscape has completely shifted. Attackers are rarely breaking down the front door anymore. They're basically sneaking in through the raw materials we use to build our digital infrastructure.
So let's just jump straight into this first story because it relies on this psychological vulnerability that I think, honestly, every single one of us falls victim to, which is visual trust.
100%.
Like when developers are writing code, they rely heavily on extensions, these little add-ons that make their software editors run better or check for errors or whatever. And they download these from massive repositories like OpenVSX.
Yeah.
But at the start of April 2026, researchers uncovered 73 fake Microsoft Visual Studio Code extensions, like 73 of them just sitting right there in the
And
marketplace.
the methodology behind this campaign, which, by the way, security researchers track as Glassworm V2, it's what makes it so insidious. Well, they didn't just upload 73 pieces of blazing malware and, like, cross their fingers hoping someone accidentally clicked on them. Out of those 73 cloned extensions, only six were confirmed to be actively malicious right out of the gate.
Wait, really? Only six?
Yeah, exactly. The vast majority of them were actually sleeper packages.
Sleeper packages. I mean, it sounds like something pulled from a Cold War spy thriller. How does a piece of software act like a sleeper agent?
It does exactly what a human sleeper agent does. It blends into the local environment, acts completely normal, and just slowly builds trust over time.
Wow.
These malicious packages use a technique called type of squatting. Basically, the attackers create a package with a name that is just like one or two letters off from a really popular legitimate tool.
Oh, like when you type a URL wrong and end up on a weird website.
Exactly like that. For example, the sources highlight this one malicious package named, and bear with me here, CENTL.VSCO Toad Language Back to ECTR. Now, to a tired developer who is just quickly searching for a Turkish language pack, that looks incredibly similar to the legitimate package, which is emotionkeyoseparate.turkishlanguagepack.
Especially if you're just glancing at the search results, right? And you see Language Pack Turan and hit download.
Exactly. And they don't stop at the name either. The attackers rip the exact same graphical icons and literally copy-paste the exact same text descriptions from the legitimate versions.
So it's essentially a fake storefront. Like it perfectly mimics your favorite local coffee shop. You walk in, the neon sign is exactly the same. The menu board is identical. The barista is even wearing the same green apron. You buy coffee there for weeks, you tell your friends, the shop builds up a loyal customer base, and then suddenly, one Tuesday, they just decide to poison the beans.
That is exactly how the social engineering works here. Because the extension initially functions perfectly, legitimate developers download it, they leave positive reviews, and they keep it installed.
Right.
And once the attackers see they have a wide enough user base, once that coffee shop is full, like you said, they push an update. And
Yeah.
that update contains the poison.
The payload.
Right. Specifically, they deploy a ZIG-based dropper, or in some cases, heavily obfuscated JavaScript, to pull down a secondary payload.
Wait, let's pause there for a second just to make sure we're defining our terms for everyone listening. What exactly is a dropper, and why does it matter so much that the JavaScript is obfuscated?
Sure. So if the fake coffee shop is the legitimate-looking front, the dropper is basically the delivery truck sneaking around to the back door.
Okay, I like that.
It's a small, seemingly harmless piece of code whose only job is to reach out to the attacker's server and just drop the actual heavy-duty malware onto the machine.
Got it. And the obfuscation.
Obfuscation is like writing the delivery manifest in invisible ink, or like a scrambled code.
Hmm.
The attackers deliberately scramble the code so that automated security scanners can't read what it's actually trying to do.
That makes perfect sense. So the delivery truck sneaks in right past the scanners. What does the malware actually do once it's inside a developer's machine?
It casts a surprisingly wide net, actually. The payload uses a command to install a malicious secondary extension, not just on Visual Studio Code, but across every integrated development environment, or IDE, on the victim's machine.
So it spreads.
Yeah. Whether the developer uses Cursor, Windsurf, VS Codeium, it gets infected.
But why go through all that trouble? Like, what is the ultimate prize they're looking for here?
Unrestricted access and data. They install a remote access Trojan, which we often call a RAT, and that essentially gives the attacker remote control over the keyboard and mouse.
Oof.
Yeah. They also stealthily deploy a rogue Chromium-based web browser extension. This just sits in the background and quietly siphons off passwords, save credentials, bookmarks, all that stuff.
Wow.
Though, interestingly enough, the code is specifically written to check the system's language settings, and it immediately aborts if it detects it's running on a Russian system.
Which gives us a pretty strong geopolitical clue about who they are actively trying to avoid angering.
Definitely.
But I have a fundamental question about how this even happens in the first place. You mentioned they're ripping off exact icons and copy-pasting descriptions.
Yeah.
Why aren't these massive repository platforms automatically catching this visual plagiarism? I mean, shouldn't a simple image recognition algorithm flag an identical icon before a developer even has the chance to download it?
It seems like an obvious fix, but it really comes down to the friction point between security and convenience in the open source world.
What do you mean?
Well, platforms like OpenVSX or NPM, they're ingesting thousands of new updates every single day. And while they do have automated scanning, attackers know those scanners are primarily looking for known malicious code signatures.
Right, but these are sleeper packages.
Exactly. When they're first uploaded, there is no malicious code to detect. As for visual matching, implementing strict copyright or image matching algorithms takes massive computational resources.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And more importantly, it frequently leads to false positives, which just blocks legitimate developers from sharing open source tools. The platforms want a frictionless environment, and the attackers are basically exploiting that exact desire.
So the quest for convenience becomes the attacker's easiest entry point.
Exactly.
Which actually transitions us perfectly to our second story.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's one thing when an individual developer at 2 a.m. gets tricked by a fake language pack.
Right.
But what happens when the victim is a massive, highly sophisticated cybersecurity company? It turns out even the security guards are getting their coffee from the same poison storefronts.
Yeah, this is where we see the domino effect of a supply chain attack truly take hold. So on March 23, 2026, the Israeli security company Checkmarks was hit by a really complex supply chain breach.
Wow.
The cyber criminal group LAPSUSC, operating through a threat actor known as Team PCP, claimed responsibility and then subsequently posted Checkmarks data right on the dark web.
LAPSUS. I mean, that is one of those names that genuinely makes corporate IT teams sweat. How on earth did they manage to breach a company whose entire business model is finding security flaws?
By entirely avoiding Checkmarks' direct perimeter. The origin of this breach is honestly a masterclass in exploiting interconnected software. It all started with an attack on Trivi.
Trivi?
Yeah, Trivi is a very popular open source vulnerability scanner.
Okay, so Trivi is essentially like a digital metal detector used to scan code for flaws.
Exactly. The attackers compromised the supply chain for that metal detector. From there, they used that access to tamper with two of Checkmarks' GitHub Actions workflows, as well as two plugins distributed via the OpenVSX marketplace, the exact same marketplace we literally just discussed with Glassworm.
Hey, let's break down that chain of events, because GitHub Actions workflows sounds incredibly dense.
Sure.
Think of a workflow like an automated assembly line in a software factory, right? It automatically tests and packages code before it gets shipped out to the public.
That's spot on. The assembly line is automated. But to do its job, the assembly line needs digital keys or authentication tokens to access different parts of the factory.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. By tampering with those workflows, the attackers pushed a credential stealer onto the assembly line to harvest those keys.
So they basically stole the keys right off the factory floor.
Exactly.
What did they actually unlock with them?
Well, one of the first things they compromised was Checkmark's KICS Docker image. KICS stands for Keeping Infrastructure as Code Secure. And a Docker image is essentially a prepackaged, standardized shipping container that holds everything a piece of software needs to run.
The irony there is so thick. They compromised the exact shipping container meant to keep infrastructure secure.
It really is.
How far down the line did this poison spread?
It just kept cascading. Because they had stolen those authentication tokens, they were able to pivot. They used those credentials to briefly compromise a completely different tool, the Bitwarden CLI NPM package.
Wait, Bitwarden?
Yeah. NPM is the massive library of pre-written code that millions of developers use, and Bitwarden is a major password manager. So by starting at a vulnerability scanner, they eventually literally laterally move their way into a package related to a password manager.
That is terrifying. And the data that actually ended up listed on the dark web, the sources mentioned source code, employee databases, API keys, and credentials for MongoDB and MySQL.
Yeah.
And just for everyone listening, MongoDB and MySQL are basically the massive digital filing cabinets where applications store their structured data, which could be anything from, you know, user logs to internal configurations.
That's right. Now, it is really important to clarify Checkmarx's official position on this incident.
Right. Let's make sure we include that.
They investigated the dark web postings, and they did confirm that data originating from their GitHub repository was indeed leaked as a result of that March 23rd attack.
Okay.
However, they made a very clear distinction here. This specific GitHub repository is maintained entirely separately from their customer production environments.
Oh.
Based on their forensic probe, Checkmark stated that no customer data was stored in that repository, and they locked down access immediately.
See, I want to dig into that, though. We take them at their word that direct customer data wasn't in this specific repository.
Sure.
But as a threat actor, what can you actually do with a security company's source code and API keys? Even if it's not a list of client names and credit cards, doesn't stealing the source code of a security tool give the attackers a massive advantage?
Oh, absolutely. It gives them the entire playbook. I mean, if you have the private source code of a security scanning tool, you don't need to guess how it works anymore.
You just study it.
Right. You can set it up in your own private lab and analyze it to find zero-day vulnerabilities. You can figure out exactly what the scanner looks for and, critically, what it is programmed to ignore. You can then design your next generation of malware specifically to fly right under Checkmark's radar.
And what about the API keys?
API keys are the digital master keys that allow different software programs to talk to each other automatically. If those leaked keys aren't immediately and aggressively revoked, attackers can use them to silently access other connected systems, third-party databases, or cloud environments that Checkmark interacts with.
So it's a stepping stone.
Exactly. It's never just about the first door they open. Mm-hmm. It's about the 10 other doors those stolen keys unlock down the line.
Which is a really sobering thought. So far, we've looked at the Glassworm attackers trying to steal credentials from individual developers and the Team PCP group going after a major security vendor for a financial payday on the dark web.
Right.
But our final source on the docket shows a massive shift in motivation. We're moving away from financial gain and looking at geopolitical hacktivism.
Yeah, this is a very different beast. We're looking at a pro-Ukrainian hacktivist group known as Phantom Core. Security researchers also track them under names like Fairy Trickster or Head Mare. They have been highly active since the 2022 Russo-Ukrainian war, and their explicit goal is breaching Russian corporate and government networks.
And just to reiterate for you listening, we're looking at this strictly from a cybersecurity mechanics perspective today. We're breaking down the vulnerabilities and the technology completely independent of the politics involved.
Exactly. Just the facts of the code.
Right. So since September 2025, Phantom Core has been heavily targeting servers running TrueConf.
TrueConf is a major enterprise video conferencing software provider, and a report from Positive Technologies detailed how Phantom Core managed to reproduce an unpublicized chain of three distinct vulnerabilities within the TrueConf software.
When you say unpublicized chain, you mean these weren't vulnerabilities that had simple exploit codes posted publicly on hacker forums somewhere?
Correct. The attackers had to do the heavy lifting themselves here. Often, this involves reverse engineering a vendor software patch.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they look at the bandage the vendor applied to figure out exactly where the underlying wound is, and then they go looking for servers that haven't applied that bandage yet.
Clever.
By chaining three of these flaws together sequentially, they achieved full authentication bypass.
Meaning?
They completely bypassed the login screen and gained administrative access to the video conferencing server.
You know, I look at a video conferencing server kind of like a corporate building's HVAC system. It seems peripheral. It's just the background utility we use to have meetings.
Yeah, exactly.
But just like an HVAC system, it is physically wired into every single room in the building. Once you get inside the vents, you have a pathway to anywhere.
That's a great way to think about it. And once they are in the vents, they start dropping what are called PHP-based web shells onto the compromised servers.
Let's translate that again. What is a web shell in plain English?
Think of it as a hidden remote control panel that the attacker accesses through a standard web browser. Once it's installed, the attacker can use it to upload new malicious files or execute commands on the server as if they were sitting right there in the server room at the keyboard.
And the sources also mentioned they set up PHP file proxy servers. Is that essentially acting like a money launderer for their web traffic?
Yes. That's a really great way to put it. A proxy server acts as a middleman. It disguises the attacker's malicious commands by routing them through legitimate-looking channels.
Which makes them hard to track.
Incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
It makes it nearly impossible for network defenders to trace where the attack is actually coming from. And they take it a step further, too.
Of course they do.
They utilize a custom DLL, which is basically a core rulebook file that the Windows operating system implicitly trusts, to literally create a rogue administrative user account named TrueConf2.
TrueConf2, I mean, they aren't exactly going for subtlety there.
No, not at all.
But I guess in a massive corporate network directory with, you know, thousands of accounts, an admin account named TrueConf2 might just look like a legitimate automated backup service to a stressed out IT administrator.
It's hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
And this group is constantly adapting too. By early 2026, they had expanded beyond just exploiting vulnerable servers.
What else were they doing?
They started using targeted phishing emails with crafted ZIP or RAR archives to drop backdoors directly onto employee laptops. They've even been observed deploying ransomware, utilizing leaked source code from notorious defunct ransomware families like Baybook and Lockbit to basically build their own encryptors.
Okay, here's where I really have to push back, though. I'm looking at the timeline provided in the research for this. TrueConf released security patches to fix these three exact vulnerabilities back on August 27, 2025.
Right.
But the Phantom Core attacks really ramped up in September and continued for months after that. If the patches exist and the vendor practically handed them out, why are these attacks still so wildly successful months later?
It is incredibly easy from the outside to just blame IT departments for being lazy and not clicking update.
Right.
But the reality of enterprise IT is vastly more complicated. Patching a core communication server that an entire organization relies on for daily operations that requires planned downtime.
Which nobody wants.
Nobody. It requires rigorous testing to ensure the new patch doesn't suddenly break integrations with existing directory services or hardware. IT departments are terrified of breaking production systems, so they delay updates.
So the fear of causing an outage actually creates the window for a breach?
Exactly. Furthermore, there's the massive issue of shadow IT.
Oh, right.
These are servers that were spun up by a specific department for a project, forgotten about, and are no longer actively managed or monitored by the central IT team at all.
Just sitting there exposed.
Right. Phantom Core and groups like them rely entirely on the gap between a patch being released by the vendor and that patch being universally applied across every forgotten server in a network.
Wow. So pulling this all together, we are looking at three very different scenarios with the exact same underlying flaw.
Yep.
We have a developer downloading a simple Turkish language pack and getting hit with a Glasswarm Trojan. We have Checkmarks, a massive security vendor, dealing with dark web leaks because a vulnerability scanner's assembly line was tampered with.
Right.
And we have massive enterprises getting hit with ransomware because they couldn't patch their video conferencing software fast enough to stop Phantom Core.
Yeah. And what all three of these incidents definitively prove is that the traditional concept of a security perimeter is just dead.
It's gone.
The firewall is no longer the boundary of your network. Today, the perimeter is every single piece of software you install. It's the open source library your developers pull down from the internet.
Right.
It's the shipping container you use to deploy your application. It's the browser extension you use to check your grammar. Every single point of digital contact is a potential point of catastrophic failure.
It's overwhelming.
It is. Trust is no longer something you can grant implicitly just because a file has a familiar icon or comes from a known vendor.
Which leaves us with a massive philosophical and technical problem to solve as we wrap up today. As threat actors increasingly rely on these automated sleeper packages, you know, software that acts perfectly normal, sometimes for months, building up genuine trust before a delayed trigger suddenly turns it malicious.
Yeah.
How does the software industry fundamentally redefine trust moving forward? If we can't trust the vendor and we can't trust our own eyes looking at the code because the payload hasn't dropped yet, where do we go?
This is a huge question.
Will we reach a point where artificial intelligence has to autonomously interrogate and sandbox every single line of code and every minor update, simulating weeks of runtime behavior before a human is even allowed to click install?
You know, it's a daunting prospect. But given the speed and trajectory of these supply chain attacks, autonomous predictive security validation might literally be the only way we can build software safely in the future.
Definitely something for you to mull over the next time your computer asks you to install a minor, seemingly harmless software update. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope we've helped you look at the digital tools you rely on daily with a much more critical eye. Remember, sometimes the biggest threat isn't the person trying to break the lock, it's the person who sold you the door. Stay curious, stay secure, and we'll catch you next time on Cyber Mornings Daily.